Welcome to Side Hustle City, and thanks for joining us. Our goal is to help you connect to real people who found success turning their side hustle into a main hustle, and we hope you can too. I'm Adam Kaler. I'm joined by Kyle Stevie, my co-host. Let's get started. Welcome back, folks, to another episode of the Side Hustle City podcast, and as always, trusty co-host Kyle Stevie.
What's up, man?
And you're remote today, Kyle.
Yeah, apparently everybody on my team's got COVID. Not like I contribute much to the conversation anyway besides stupid questions, so we're good.
Well, today you may be able to jump in here or learn a little bit about your home state of Kentucky because we have Ash Atkinson on today. How you doing, Ash?
Hey, what's up, guys? I am doing amazing.
Awesome. So Ash and I got to meet each other because a buddy of ours, Dan Pearson, started a real estate fund, kind of a hard money real estate fund. He was able to raise like $20 million in like, what, a year and a half or something, I think?
Yeah, just about that. Yeah, I mean, Rich is right now in Miami as we speak, trying to round up the last investors to get it done. So
Yeah. And we're both advisors on their fund, which sounds like a really good deal for us. We just, you know, our pictures and our little story on the deck and the website, and, you know, we benefit.
Yep. Every once in a while we have to check over a deal, but that's about it. Yeah.
Well, and my favorite thing about it is they go out here. This is the first fund they've ever raised. So these guys, Kyle, they're, you know, one of them worked in the gym world and the other one worked as an executive at Disney for a while. Nothing to do with real estate. Dan had to negotiate a lease probably for his space or whatever in the Crew Tower downtown. But, you know, nobody's ever raised money for a fund or for a startup or anything before. And next thing you know, these guys are raising $20 million.
So who's like their, so they're great sales guys. Who's the expert behind them? Who's helping them with the properties? Is it you two?
So they've got a Facebook.
A bunch of people.
There was a Facebook group that they joined, and I can't remember the guy's name that started the Facebook group, but they learned everything. They just soaked it all up, you know, took the classes. Right. I think the course was, what, like a couple thousand bucks, Ash?
Yeah, so I don't want to plug it because we're on a podcast, but yeah.
Oh, no, you're fine. You can plug it.
Okay.
People learn, you know.
I mean, maybe I should get an affiliate link out of this, but it's called Investment Fund Secrets. So basically, there's a guy, his name is Bridget Pennington, and he teaches people how to raise capital and start funds, regardless of your experience level. So there's been like several hundred people at this point that have been through and a bunch have started their own funds. So
I saw marketing and advertising for him. I saw it on, I think it was Facebook.
Yeah.
He wanted to start a fund, yeah.
Yeah, so they did it, you know, and they went through it and they actually did it. So $20 million later, they're getting ready to deploy that capital into some investments, and they're doing hard money loans to multifamily investors. So like a lot of the guys we've had on our show, Kyle, they would probably be the ones who would get this kind of money. But they have, I think, four or five different operators that they're working with right now. That are trusted, that have done number of projects in the past, and they trust them to do a good job and use the money wisely. So big risk, but I mean, they're swinging for the fences here, and you know, it could mean a lot of money for them. Life-changing career choice for both of them. So I'm waiting for Rich to go buy that house in Golden Oak so we can get through those get through that gated community there down in Orlando.
Seriously, he had a house picked out. I'm not sure. It's probably already sold by now, but he was actively looking there for a minute. So hopefully we can get that done for him soon enough.
Yeah, it's a great investment. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good investment. So, but anyway, Ash, so you, sir, are in the horse business and you are European, as people could probably tell, British, right?
Yeah. So I'm from England originally, but I've spent a lot of time in, Germany, and I lived in Mexico also before I moved to the States. So a lot of people will be listening in thinking this guy's accent is definitely not like full British. So there's something going on. There's something weird, but it's just purely because I've lived in so many different places over the years. And the accent's got a little bit all kind of out of twang, as they like to call it. But I'm full British. My family still lives in the UK. I grew up like an hour north of London.
Nice. So how was what got you into the horse business? So you essentially trade, you buy horses from England, have them shipped to the United States, train them here, raise them and train them, and then sell them to mostly wealthy individuals, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so a little bit backstory. So, well, first of all, so people are aware, we focus on equestrian. So we look at show jumping and hunter type horses, which are, so it's not, we're not racing horses, not kind of any of that stuff, which typically most people, especially because we spend a lot of time in Kentucky, a lot of people think we're in that world of racing or that. We're not. We are show jumping. So jumping jumps, like that equestrianism stuff. So basically, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up in the English countryside, and horses are a big part of that. And so when I was probably 10, 12 years old, I was going past a riding school, and, you know, I told my dad, like, hey, I want to go ride a horse. It's like, all right, fine. And so I went and took some lessons and absolutely fell in love with horses and with riding, and just kind of from there, it really started. And over those, you know, years, kind of in my teenage years, I was riding horses, kind of graduated to going to competitions. You know, I was very fortunate, even though my family isn't well off by any means, you know, very middle class. They always did everything they could support me to help me buy horses. I bought my first pony for, like, I think it was 900 British pounds. So, I mean, that's probably about 1200 US. And just kind of started from there. And then I just kept building up. And, you know, when I was finished high school, I decided that actually I wanted to become professional. You know, at the time I had this vision of going to the Olympics and competing for my country. And so that was kind of the goal initially when I graduated high school. And then I went and spent a couple of years in Germany working for one of the largest horse breeder producers on the planet. They breed 5,000 horses a year, which Whoa. Is just phenomenal. Yeah. A lot of horses. And I mean, that's really where it started for me. You know, it's like anyone that goes into any type of business world, you know, you want to go to the best of the best. Like if you want to go into, you know, being in the hedge fund world or being a trader, you're going to go to, you know, Goldman Sachs, yeah. For example. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, you know, this is basically who I went to was like the Goldman Sachs of the equestrian world, and learned the business, really learned how to ride horses. You know, we're really for us. So again, I don't want to go too much down into the world of it, but, you know, whereas in racing, for example, they're racing 2 and 3 year old horses. For us in our business, we don't start riding these horses to at least 4 or 5 years old. So typically in the racing world, they're already done with the horses. We're not even started with ours yet. They're still for us, not even ready. And typically for us, the peak of their ability is around like 9 or 10 years old. So like a lot later.
Oh, wow.
And they'll go until, you know, some go until retirement, which could be 18 to 20 years old if you manage them right. So we have a lot more, you know, in that time frame, but then, you know, we start a lot later and it takes a lot longer to really train them for that level as well. But yeah, so, I mean, I spent a couple of years in Germany and learned everything, learned the business, made some amazing connections and really learned what I was doing. But, you know, I spent a couple of years there and I said, look, I want to try somewhere else. Went to Mexico, worked for a super wealthy, one of the probably top 5 wealthiest guys in Mexico. He again had a breeding operation, had a lot of young horses. I was riding, competing. And then, you know, I decided again, I wanted to shift and I moved to the States. I was in California first. And kind of when I came to the States, that's really when my mind started to shift, because what I realized was there was a real great opportunity whereby it's not like I invented the wheel here by any means. I carved out an opportunity for myself within that, which was in the US, typically speaking, no one really breeds or really produces the younger horses in the US because it's so expensive to keep horses in the US compared to really anywhere in Europe or really, and honestly, anywhere else I've ever lived. And what I realized was that people typically, like American trainers were sourcing horses in Europe that then they would look for, they would buy them and they would bring them to the US. And typically either they would then be like middlemen and either maybe selling them to their wealthy clients, or they would have them for themselves and ride them and whatever the case may be. So I just thought, okay, well, look at this. So I have all these connections in Europe. I'm from there. I grew up there. I spent a lot of time in Germany. I'm living here in the States, whereby I understand the market. I understand typically what American trainers, American, you know, equestrians are looking for in terms of the type of horses, you know, the level of ability, what is capable of being done here. And so I was like, look, so here's my opportunity. I'm going to source these horses in Europe, bring them to the States. You know, I'm going to produce them and train them myself, make them really kind of Americanized almost, and then sell them to these wealthy individuals, these kind of what you class as more amateur riders. So they're really just doing it because of the love of riding horses and competing and all that. They're not doing it for any professional gain. And so started that. I was riding a lot of horses, doing a lot of that. And then really as it progressed, I actually realized that, honestly, I got super burnt out the riding aspect of the sport. Like I got tired. I was riding a lot of horses every day. So you can imagine, you know, riding 10 horses a day is incredibly exhausting. And I just honestly, my passion was more on the business side. I'm an entrepreneur at heart. So I was like, look, how can I leverage myself better so that I can do the parts I love and also look to do other business stuff, other business interests as well. Like you said, Adam, at the start of the podcast, you know, what we're doing with the real estate fund, all these different things that I have a passion for. And so I completely removed myself from the riding side of the sport, brought in other people. I have a partner that also now rides a lot of these horses. And basically I focus on now having a really great pool of investors, whereby when I find a horse in Europe that I really like, I say, look, we can bring it to the US, you know, we'll put this amount of time, this amount of money into it when it's here, go to horse shows, get it, you know, get some real promotion behind it, train it a little bit, and then say, oh, this is what, you know, likely we'll get in this, blah, 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 and kind of trying to figure out the numbers there. And then we do that. So really now the business has shifted whereby I just manage the investors. I manage the financial aspect. And, you know, with my partner, we find the horses and do all that. So it's definitely been a real progression there. And it's definitely been an interesting business.
Nice. Kyle, what do you think about this?
I didn't know this part of the horse game existed. I kind of seemed similar. I had a friend that used to go to dealerships for Mercedes-Benz that they would sell here in the U.S., but you couldn't get them internationally. And then they would he would train the car for the year that he had to hold it before he could send it internationally. And so by the time these guys got their cars, they paid less than they would pay to ship it and do all this stuff if they'd ordered it directly from the U.S. But B, the car was ready to rock and roll and it had already been broken in. So I know this isn't apples to apples analogy. But if I'm getting this right, you get to spend all your time in Europe with hoity-toity clientele looking at horses, and then you find one that you like, and then you guys kind of like break it in a little bit to send it to the U.S. so it's ready to be trained properly. Is that right?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, because of COVID, the model's definitely shifted, because typically, as you're right, yeah, we would go to Europe for a week and we would just drive around France, Germany, Holland, wherever, and look for horses. We would ride them ourselves, kind of like verify that they actually, you know, they are what we thought they are, pick the ones we like the most, do like a pre-purchase inspection, which is kind of same if you're buying buying a house, you know, you're going to do that. You do that appraisal, make sure everything's, you know, look under the foundations, you know, make sure everything checks out, and then we purchase it and then we ship them to the US and then go about training them here and then planning obviously to sell them at some point. So that was our kind of pre-COVID model. And then when COVID came, we really shifted to being very selective. So really now I'm very selective about who I do business with in Europe, because, and this is where really we, and myself, I mean, we have the advantage in the fact that because I'm from Europe, I grew up there, I have a lot of great contacts there. I know the people who I can trust to work with there and the people that I want to avoid at all costs. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the US, you know, they go on Facebook and there's all these American, you know, big dealers, horse dealers in Europe that post videos of all these different horses, and, you know, people that maybe don't necessarily know these people very well, they purchase these horses from, they wire the money to Europe. And this has happened. I know people this happened to, whereby this person in Europe has actually sent them a different horse to the one they sent videos showing this is the horse actually you're buying.
I've heard this is a problem. Because people in Kentucky said, oh, you got to watch out with the horse business because, you know, people will send you the wrong horse or they'll send you the different horse. And I've heard about this. So you really need somebody there to look at the horse, verify this is the horse you're getting. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So for us now, I'm like I say, I've really narrowed the pool of people who I do business with to, and it goes the same other way as well. So like now, you know, there's one particular guy we buy pretty much say 80% of our horses through. And I just tell when he sends me a bunch of videos and we look through, okay, what we like, if we decide, okay, we want to go on one, he'll already prepare the paper before we even wire the money, because it's a mutual respect thing. When I say this is one we're buying, he knows the money's going to get wired and he's preparing the paperwork. But when it gets here, I know with 100% certainty that everything he told me what that horse is, you know, just even down to its character, you know, if it has any issues, if it's funny about, you know, touching its head, like whatever it is, we're going to know everything before it gets this. That way there's never any surprises. And having it's again, just comes down to like any business you're in, having the right partners, having the right contacts, having those trusted networks and sources whereby you do what you say and they do by you what they say they're going to do. That's always going to be the most crucial thing. And having those relationships avoids having those issues. So that means, for example, with the investors I have, and most of the investors I have actually aren't horse people. One is a pilot for Southwest Airlines, for example. Another one's a doctor. Like, they don't know horses, but they trust us because they know we can, first of all, do what we, you know, we actually are able to do what we say we're going to do. And we have a proven model. But in the fact that where we source these horses as well is from legitimate sources we've done years of business with. And we know, you know, the entire sort of network is going to be able to function as it should.
Yeah, because this sounds really interesting to me, Kyle, because, you know, most of these people, it sounds like they're looking for diversification, obviously, right? You're looking for something that could potentially, you know, you could hit a home run with it or the horse could die. Like, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of risk involved in that. What are the chances, like, you invest in a horse and something happens to it? It, you know, falls down, breaks its leg, you know, something, you know, some weird stuff happens. I mean, how often does that go down?
Are you tired of feeling lost in the world of trading and investing? Get informed and inspired with the Talking Trading podcast. I'm Louise Bedford, and I'll help you navigate the markets like a pro. Tune in each week and subscribe now at talkingtrading.com.au or on your favourite podcast app, or check out the link in the show notes. Talking Trading, this is how traders excel.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as you said, I mean, those are big issues. I mean, we're definitely in a business where it's a high risk, high reward type of asset class. I typically and kind of put it to, and you know, up to recently, I had a very wealthy investor, you know, a billionaire with us. Unfortunately, he died a couple of months back. So, but you know, before he ever invested in a horse with us, I said, look, and it doesn't matter if, you know, if it's a billionaire, if it's someone that's just, you know, got some extra capital they want to put into a deal. You know, be prepared that, you know, could lose all your money. We do everything we can to mitigate that risk. But it's definitely can happen. If you are comfortable with that, having that, you know, and being me setting that expectation, and if you're good with that, then okay, we can proceed, but otherwise we're not going to move forward. So, you know, we can, obviously we buy insurance, which is great, but insurance only covers what the purchase value is. So as you can imagine, you know, if say, for example, we pay 50,000 euro, this is, all right, let's go with US to make it more simple, $50,000 to buy a horse, but then we've got to spend another $10,000 to put it on a flight to get to the US, plus quarantine, plus, you know, the first month's hay and feed and all the stuff. And then, you know, to actually goes into, you know, the time. And then we've got competition bills and potential vet bills and vaccinations and all the things coming to that. I mean, you can rack up another 20-30K in a couple of months just from those things. So if something was to happen that's, you know, actually end of life scenario, there is obviously a gap where you know, there can be money can be lost. So that there's that risk for sure. But I mean, we are, again, I've been in this business for 18 years, you know, and we do everything we can to mitigate those risks. We have great staff that look after the horses. You know, I have cameras in my barn that I can just check if anything's going on, you know, when we're not there. You know, and we're very careful about just what we do with them. We have a very structured training routine. We have great vets that we work with that, you know, we have great chiropractic people that look after the horses. We have a lot of systems we put in place to really mitigate a lot of the risks. But I mean, again, it's like it's a live animal. It's, you know, no difference. It's and again, more than that, it's an athlete. And like any athlete, you know, shit can happen and stuff can go sideways. But, and I've had friends that have had, you know, actually literally about a month ago, guy that his horse went to the Olympics for Switzerland. I don't recall exactly his result, but the horse had been winning consistently gold medals and other stuff prior to the Olympics, and then came back from Olympics, went out in the pasture to eat some, you know, for a couple of hours in a field. And something happened, fell down and broke his shoulder. And I don't know if that horse is ever going to come back again. And I mean,
wow,
you can't even put a valuation on that horse. That horse was probably worth several million dollars.
Golly, like, I guess you studded out at that point if it can't perform anymore though, right?
I mean, if it's a stallion, yes. If if it's not a, you know, not a female horse, or we have stallions and we have geldings, which is basically the geldings are the ones that had their balls chopped off. So, that one is actually a gelding, which is the name. So he actually, you can't even breed with him. Unfortunately, at that point, it's kind of useless. So I don't know if that horse will come back. I mean, I've not heard anything recently, but you know, there's a lot can happen just from, you know, freak things can happen, unfortunately. But yeah, again, we just do everything we can to mitigate it.
Wow. You've been doing this for 18 years?
Yes. Well, since I started riding. Yeah. And then the last 10 years has been, you know, actually professionally. And then the last real 5 years has been, you know, us actually having this investment structure model and kind of iterated it and to the point we are now. Yeah.
Cause you look like you're like 22. So I was wondering,
the horse business is easy. Like, look at this guy. He gets to be around horses.
I don't know how. I mean, I just turned 30 in January and I'm getting some gray hair. So, I mean, it's a stressful business. So, yeah, I don't know.
So a life of wines and cheeses, driving through the countryside in Europe to ride horses, it can be a little bit taxing, eh? Getting some of the grays on the side.
Trust me, it's a lot more work than you realize, for sure.
So, yeah, so what is...
Sure it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So what is, you know, what's a potential return on something like this? You know, I mean, everybody's like, oh, side hustles. And, you know, when do you have to put the money in? How long is the money locked up? And then what kind of return do you think on average people could get?
Yeah, I'm really interested. Sorry to cut you off. I'm really interested in this one too, because when people think of horses, they think of the purses that you get at Preakness or Churchill Downs or whatever on these simulcast races that you see, but they don't think about the other types of competitions, you know, that like horses participate in. So it's really interesting to me to see if this is like a $100,000 payout or if this is like $2 million purses for winning competitions.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting in my sport is unless you're at the real like top end of the sport in terms of like the highest level show jumping competitions, it's very hard, actually, even in the US in particular, very hard to actually make money from competing and actually going to horse shows. However, we have to take our horses to shows to get the proven results in order to make them more valuable. So it's kind of a catch 22 situation whereby, you know, we take them to shows because it's, you know, we have to get results to show the horse has, you know, get some good videos to promote, you know, people are there, so they're going to see them and all that kind of stuff. But it's also a case of, you know, we don't typically make money from going to actually competing them. So it really comes down to, okay, well, what is our entry number and what is our exit number? And obviously what are the costs between that? And it's honestly, It fluctuates massively. I mean, we've had situations whereby, you know, I purchased one for, what do we have into it? Maybe, I think it was like 25,000. This is a relatively recent case study. So bought it for 25,000 and then all the fees in, only owned that horse for a month. We made, I think we probably made around 80% on our money in about a month on that one. And I've had another one whereby I had for 3 months and, you know, I'll keep it super simple and on the easier end. I mean, that one we made, I think 200% of our money in just 3 months.
Wow.
But then we've had others whereby, you know, I had one recently, unfortunately, where we, you know, lost maybe 5% on our money. We had it for a long time. And at that point, you know, obviously we didn't make any money. We spent a lot of time and energy and effort. We had that one for 6 months and, for bad luck, bad circumstances, unfortunately, you know, we had to take a little bit of a loss. So, and again, you know, we put a lot of our time and energy into it and, you know, nothing came of it. So it can be fluctuate massively. You know, we aim for 30%, really annualized 30% is really what we want to achieve. But typically speaking, our whole time, we really plan for a whole time of anywhere between a year and 18 months. Nothing I have in my barn right now, we've had actually, honestly, for more than 18 months. I would say everything we have right now, we've purchased in the last 8 to really 8 months. Mm. So, and a couple of getting ready, we're about to sell. And then we have a couple others we're going to hold for a bit longer. So it's a combination of, you know, cash reserves is a big part of it, because again, the overhead is very high to contain and to maintain these horses and all the costs and feed and everything, as I spoke of. But, you know, some, as I said, you know, we can find horses in Europe. You know, again, going back to the example I gave a minute ago, we purchased the one we lost money on, unfortunately. We purchased it exactly the same time as another horse, the same age, the same type of horse, actually the same job as well, at that same time. And one of those horses we made, we made like probably a $30,000 profit on that horse in a month. And the other one, as I said, exactly the same type of horse, we kept it for 6 months and we ended up selling it for a loss. Like, it's just things can happen, you know? But I mean, what's great is we're very fortunate, or not for it, just knowledge and experience of knowing what we like, knowing what works, knowing what sells, and just really, you know, I have like a little Excel model, like, you know, model out the numbers and figure out, okay, what do we need? You know, when are we going to need to ask the investors to put some more capital in to continue the relationship and moving forward. But, and then, you know, we're kind of interesting position too, whereby, you know, almost like a real estate deal. We have some horses right now that, you know, imagine if you're doing a fix and flip, you know, and it's like a case of where we have some, we have a couple of horses actually, whereby, you know, it's like you're halfway through renovating the house. And it's like, do you sell now because you need the capital back? Or do you just put another 20, 30 grand in and make, you know, 100K more because you finished the house? And that's a little bit of a similar situation. We have a couple of horses right now whereby, you know, we've got to put a little bit more money in, but it's going to mean we're going to get that real bump in the return because it's going to be more of almost more of a finished product that we know is more commercial. We can go out to a bigger net of potential buyers and amateur riders that would actually, you know, be more interested at the higher dollar amount. So it fluctuates massively. It varies a lot. But, you know, I just try to keep to basic principles, really.
There's a lot of things that would have to play into when you sell the horse. It's not necessarily like, oh, yeah, you know, we open a fund and we close the fund 6 years later. That's not like the way your thing works. It's, hey, we got to, you know, buy the horse. We got to, you know, bring the horse over, you know, take him to some shows. And maybe a month later, 2 months later, maybe a year later, the horse sells. What was the percentage that you shoot for?
Like 30% is realistic. Definitely realistic. I mean, I'd say on an annualized basis, but honestly, you know, 30% is doable. Again, it really depends on that particular horse. I mean, we can make 30% in, you know, a month potentially, or it could be longer, or a year, or whatever.
And that's not a bad return at all.
No.
And you haven't had many problems with horses like dying or anything like that, it sounds like, in all the years you've been doing this. I mean, it's a hardy animal. It's not like a fragile thing. I mean, even a football player is more fragile than a horse. So, I mean, there's only so many things that they could hurt themselves on, right?
Yeah. And again, we're just very mindful of how we go about the way we operate. And, you know, a lot of injuries in the horse business come from either negligence or just, you know, just not acting in the way people should. And a lot of times horses get injured because, you know, people haven't necessarily taken the right care of them. I mean, for example, it's like a football player, like after my horses compete, they get ice on their legs, you know, to cool down inflammation and anything like that. So, you know, we have a chiropractor, we have different things like that, that maintain the horses. They're on amazing feed. You know, it's the same as human beings. You know, you feed them correctly. You give them the real, we spend a lot of money on our hay, for example, because I won't just feed them any cheap shit. Like spend more money on our hay, and that's a big expense every month. Trust me. And when we're thinking about, you know, what our spread between our expenses and our profit is, it gets tight because of just purely of the hay. But I'm like, I want to feed my horses good hay so they feel good, they're healthy, they're looking good, so they're going to perform and do well in the competitions. That way they will do well and we can sell them for good money. So it's a lot of factors we have to really.
So Kyle, so this definitely sounds like something that I could invest in. It could be hands-off, or anybody could invest in. It could be a hands-off investment. You don't really have to know a lot about horses, but Kyle, it'd be cool to tell people you're invested in horses. Oh, what do you do? A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Rental property. I invest in horses.
Yeah, especially since Ash just said that he's going to guarantee us a 30% return on each horse.
Hey, you might get an 80% return. You're going to get 50% back?
Hey, you can get, I mean, anything's possible, like I say. Not guaranteeing anything, but, you know, anything's possible. And really, the way we do it, I structure on a deal-by-deal basis. So, there's no formal fund per se set up. I'm thinking about the idea of maybe actually formulating in a fund structure, but really right now we just do on a deal by deal basis. I mean, I was, you know, again, kind of experienced here. I had one horse that had six investment partners and I will never do that again. It was the worst decision. You know, they were all people that weren't in the horse business, but they were very controlling and very questioned everything we did. And it's like, you know, combined between me and my partner, we've been doing this for like 40 plus years. So like, we don't need people that don't know the sport to tell us kind of how to do this. So, you know, typically I only, you know, I source the deal first. And, you know, if I have someone say, hey, look, you know, I have this opportunity. This is what I think. This is what's going to cost. This is what I think we can get it done for. And, you know, that would be with really at most two partners on that deal. That's really the max I want going forward. Just again, experience. And if we do that deal, awesome. Then we put everything together, wire the money, and we just go with it. And that's that. And, you know, I could say we update as frequently as not as possible. Again, you know, as I said to you, we have this pilot that's an investor and he checks in once a month. Hey, how's it going? You know, is it still alive? We're like, yep. And that one's actually going amazing. And when we go to sell that horse in particular, that man is going to do extremely well on his return because we got a really good deal on that one. But, you know, we just different ways. But I mean, like I say, you know, typically I don't like to have more than two investors in any one deal. And once we sell that horse, I mean, it's up to that investor. If they want to put their money back in and go again, fantastic. If not, then that's fine. I mean, obviously take your return and, you know, be on your way. It's either or for us. You know, there's always people looking to do these type of deals.
What kind of waiting list do you have? If you're only taking two investors per horse, what kind of, like, are you backlogged?
No, honestly, no, because I'm not actively sourcing investors. You know, if I have a deal that comes up and, you know, somebody hits me up and says, hey, like, you know, when you have a deal, you know, put some money in, then great. But I don't solicit for capital. I'm typically speaking in my business too, you know, if it's a good deal, it's like a real estate deal, you know, if it's a good deal, you're going to find investors for it. So, either I just, you know, people I have in existing in my network, but it's not like a case of if a new investor wants to come in, then honestly, they probably, if anything, have more of an opportunity to come in because, you know, I like to, the investors I have currently, I don't really like to have them owning more than one horse, just because like, I don't want them kind of, you know, mixing the two, or, you know, sort of maybe if they've got to put more money into one, they're like, well, we need to sell this one so I can keep paying expenses on the other one. I don't want to have that kind of situation occur. So it's like, if you own one, you know, you're owner, half owner, 50% owner or whatever in one horse, then we'll just keep you in that scenario until we ultimately sell that one. And then sure, you can reinvest your profits into another one. But, that's really how I structure it.
What's a minimum investment that you generally take?
I mean, honestly, because
depends on the horse, I'm sure.
Yeah. It depends on the horse per se, but typically for us, again, there's a different levels to the market. And for us, you know, the horses we buy in Europe are anywhere between sort of 20,000 and 80,000, like in that kind of range. That's typically what we operate in. So really it's anywhere between, $20,000 and $40,000 more or less in terms of like minimum investment, I would say. But it, again, you know, it's on a horse by horse basis. And it's not even about the purchase price. It's about the expenses, the running expenses side, the import expenses to get the horse over to the US, and all those kind of factors are, if anything, are probably more crucial than actually just the initial capital to go in.
Interesting. So if you had four people, like one group, and maybe like one contact, but four people in a group, that might actually be kind of ideal.
Yeah, like a little LLC.
Yeah. But you had one point of contact, and that person went back to the rest of the group and told them what was going on with the horse.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a little bit the situation we had with the six people. But again, that was just too many, because there was too many opinions. And even though it was technically one like point person, the deal just got super messy, and we were like, all right, this is not, it's causing us more stress than anything. So we're just going to sell this one, give you guys your money and kind of move on. So really, again, I wouldn't like to do more than two. Again, we established an LLC with two individual investors. That's fine, or whatever that looks like. For my work, again, if you have four people, and as you said, one, you know, Adam is the point person, and the others are passive, and they remain passive, and they don't try to interfere. Fantastic.
You know what would work?
Come, I mean, again, it's not like we're saying, hey, like, don't get involved. Like, hey, you want to come to a horse competition? You know, we're based in Florida primarily, like 100% of the time during the winter, but in the summer, we're up in Lexington, Kentucky. We're in Nashville, Tennessee. We got to Traverse City, Michigan. You know, we'll be in Tryon, North Carolina in the next week after next. So, you know, we actively are traveling to horse competitions. So if one of our investors is in the area and they want to come see the horse, you know, great. You know, we send videos, we send photos, like we give updates all the time to our investors. And again, some investors are like, you know, check in, tell me what's going on once a month, and others are one all the time, want to know what's going on. You know, so again, I'm not saying not be involved, but it's the case of also like, you know, we know what we're doing. Let us actually manage the investment. Let us do what we need to do to ensure the horses, you know, interests are the most important part of this. And, you know, let's go out and do everything we can to get you a return and us to return the process. Because probably one thing I've not mentioned, which is the most critical part of all, we don't make any money until this horse sells. So on the acquisition side, on all the hours of training, the time, everything else we put in, we don't make any of that money. Like, we make nothing. And so we have the best interests at heart, because we also want to be selling this horse, because we don't make any money until that horse sells on the back end. So, you know, for us, we have all the motivation in the world, because our investors, not when they're paying monthly expenses, it's for monthly expenses. It's not us tacking on our hours or training fees or anything else. That's not part of the deal. Like, we are as motivated as anything to sell the horse when it's right to sell it, because again, we're not making money until that happens.
Pretty cool. This is different, Kyle. I mean, it's kind of the same kind of structure, just with a more, I'd say, like, with more unknowns. Like, we don't know how well the horse is going to sell for. We don't know how long it's going to take to sell. Ash, you guys have a like a group of buyers that you typically go to and say, hey, look, we got a new horse. It's trained up. What do you guys think?
Yeah, there's kind of a, there's some of that, and you kind of just somewhat touch on the point you're about to go down, Adam. Like it's very similar in a lot of aspects to a real estate deal, other than the fact that, you know, we, to an extent, like the horses we look at, the horses we buy, typically, you know, just from being in this business so long, we have at least somewhat of an idea of where that horse's capability is going to be. And, you know, we, the market, to an extent, there's somewhat of a, okay, this horse, this age, this type is going to be worth this amount. Like there is a very, it's relatively understood to an extent, okay, based on all these different parameters of what evaluations look like, which look at the real estate market, you know, in terms of look, actually analyzing a market, you know, comps, all that kind of stuff. There is a way, obviously, you know, when you look at a rent, you know, maybe a fix and flip opportunity, you see this house in this neighborhood. Okay, well, given its current state, you know, we're buying it for this amount. You know, we need these investors to come in. And obviously based on that, you know, when we go to sell it, you know, at market value, fully rehabbed, it's going to be, you know, whatever that number is. So there is an element of us somewhat being able to predict and understand, okay, what it looks like. Obviously the unknowns, as you said, are the fact that, you know, maybe the horse dies. So it's like, you know, at least the land is worth something when it comes to a real estate asset. Like for us, you know, if it dies, we just get the insurance payout, but that's kind of it, you know? And yeah, something can happen. It can get injured and be off for 6 weeks, you know, or whatever. And that can cause, or something happens, or, you know, there's just so many variables when it comes to live animals. So there's a lot of factors in there, but I mean, it's, yeah, that's kind of really.
Kyle, yeah. I'm seeing an opportunity here with our farm guy and Ash. So like, renting farms with these horse, oh, yeah, the horse situation and this feed, all this like hay, like there could be like a, some kind of mutually beneficial situation going on here.
It kind of feels like a little bit too, like, are you a soccer fan or, a football fan?
it's funny. I get asked that all the time overseas. I'm British, but, what's funny about like soccer, football, whatever, it's definitely a religion back in England. And, my family weren't into it, so therefore I was never into it. I have friends that their parents, their grandparents, you know, it's their way of life and they adore it. So honestly, no.
Okay. Well, so then, I mean, I still think you have an understanding of what I'm about to say. So Adam, yeah, if a South American kid is in a club soccer setting, he's a 7-year-old and he signs with a local club and he gets trained by this local club for 5 years. And then he goes to a bigger local, the bigger club in say Argentina, he goes to River Plate or whatever. And then they sell him to, I don't know, Ajax or some mid big club, but like a smaller version of a big club in Europe. And then Ajax sends him to somebody in the Premier League. Every time they get transferred, that original owner gets a little sliver of the transfer fee. So not the original owner, but the original. So like here in Cincinnati, King's Hammer, they produce a kid that becomes an all-world athlete. Every club that he signs with, because they sell players, they don't trade them like in baseball, they sell them for money. King's Hammer would get a cut of that every single time he signs with a new club.
Oh.
You see what I'm saying?
Like an NFT?
So how often, Ash, do these horses get sold after you've raised them and you've taken them to shows and you sell them? Do they generally just like one more owner and that's it, or do they trade hands often after that?
Honestly, I'm actually glad you brought this up because I would have brought it up myself. Yeah. Typically speaking, for us in the US market, as I said earlier, it's in the US, it's very amateur centric. Like it's all about, you know, people that just really enjoy horses competing. You know, they're not in it for financial gain, because typically speaking they're already super wealthy. And you know, we actually on a regular basis see extremely wealthy people at the horse shows. I mean, Adam, when we were on the phone call the other week, there was a, you know, Miley Cyrus's sister was literally rode past me like at the horse show. Like there's a lot of extremely wealthy people that we, you know, we actually actively are involved with and we end up selling to, and they're not in it for financial gain. So typically speaking, yeah, they are likely to be the end user. You know, it's like, you know, they're paying, you know, the top dollar amount. They're not looking necessarily to make a deal or anything like that. They're like, this is my horse. This is what I want. I want to have the enjoyment of riding it, the enjoyment of competing it. And that's honestly, for the most part, that's normally, you know, how it is, or, you know, it's normally there. We call it your forever home. You know, it's the last place the horse ends up. I mean, that doesn't always happen. I mean, I've sold horses to someone that's like myself, and they've had it for maybe a year or two longer, and then sold it for even more money down the road because they had maybe more of a financial means to continue to produce that horse for longer and then sell it for an even bigger amount. Sure, that happens all the time. I just know for us that, you know, there's typically for us, there's always a, as I said, there's a least amount we purchase for, and it's typically speaking, we'll get to a position whereby, you know, it's time for us to exit. You know, maybe somebody else will come in that has an even greater capital stack that can continue to go with that. If that horse has the potential to go higher, we'll continue down that path. But for the most part, yeah, to kind of long-winded way of me answering your question, for the most part, it's the end user.
Okay.
Well, this isn't
shit. That was another stream of income that I was thinking about that doesn't exist because that's not part of the industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's what's the tough thing about what my industry is, it's very backward to an extent. It's very sort of very slow to adopt new technologies and new ideas, new opportunities. It's dealing with horse people or kind of country people for the most part. So everything's a little bit more on the slower, the, you know, side. People have started, almost like an eBay for horses where, you know, you put horses online and try and sell them through that. And like, you know, or whatever else, and they never take off because people just don't want to adapt to new technologies. They're, you know, I've known people that have created, like, there's an app that's great for, it's like a, almost like a project management for horses. So it's like a horse management software. So you can go in there, you can put in, okay, the training schedules and feed and, you know, just kind of keep track. Okay. When the black, you know, we have a farrier, so it puts new shoes on. When the vet comes, what we did, blah, blah, blah. And it's a great piece of software, but most people are just happy with a whiteboard and just writing notes up and having it there, which is just, I mean, in this day and age, it's crazy. So yeah, in my industry, they're very slow to adapt to new technologies, new ideas, and which is unfortunate, but I mean, it is what it is. You gotta work with what you got.
So it really is a lot like real estate.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? I mean, there are a lot of similarities, it sounds like. I mean, you could potentially flip a horse faster than flipping a house. I mean, it's, you know, you're not renting your horse out. Is there any, Ash, is there any kind of like renting these show horses or anything? Is there like an Airbnb? Yeah, Turo for horses?
Yeah, I mean, we do leases all the time. Actually, I literally last week leased a horse on a 12-month lease. We do that all the time too. It's kind of one of those scenarios whereby it's almost like either do you sell the house or do you, you know, rent it, lease it out, whatever. It's like, are you comfortable with somebody else using your piece of property, potentially abusing it? Potentially, you know, leaving it comes back to you in a really shitty condition. You know, it's almost like, you know, how you do with real estate, you're vetting the tenants. It's like, we're vetting the trainer, we're vetting the person that's going to get it. So I don't really like to lease horses. I have a good, honestly, it was a guy I used to work for years ago. He is, you know, he has he owns like 200 horses and he just leases them out year after year. And he makes just phenomenal cash flow from doing that, which his model works for that because he's doing it at such a high level. I don't, typically speaking, you know, we try not to tie up capital, you know, too long for too often because I'm much, you know, we're a much smaller operation. You know, we have no more than 6 horses really. Right now we have 10, trying to get that back down to, you know, 5 or 6 at any one time. I really want to keep a lean, you know, tight knit operation. And I've had bad experiences too. I had a horse, you know, I'm on in a lawsuit right now. I had a horse actually stolen from me through a lease. They didn't give it back at the end of the lease. It's been a nightmare to deal with. So
wow.
Again, it comes down to, and that's a learning experience for me of coming down to just ensuring that if I go about leasing a horse, it's because I feel this is a better strategy in terms of actually us getting capital back for our investors and for us, but also, you know, is it the right person to go to for the right reasons, the right opportunity, and everything comes like that. But typically speaking, when I look at deals of horses we're going to buy, I'm looking at them from the standpoint of like, I'm going to sell them. But You know, not everyone does that. Again, same real estate. Not everybody wants to go and fix and flip. Some people want to, you know, buy and either do a burr or like just want to, you know, purchase and rent it out or whatever they want to do. I mean, it's each their own and what your risk tolerance is, what your capital reserves look like and all those kind of things.
What kind of money can you get for a horse on a lease, like a 1 year lease like that?
Really anything from maybe 20,000 to, you know, 125,000 on a year lease. I know people have, you know, leased horses for that kind of money. But typically, so just, I guess a rough rule of thumb, you know, typically speaking, you lease a horse for around, you know, somewhere between 40 and 60% of the value of what you think that horse is on a, that's really kind of a rule of, you know, somewhat a rule of thumb of how people kind of price a lease compared to, and you know, we do somewhere where lease option to buy, you know, where we'll lease it for 6 months with option to buy it at the end of 6 months for maybe X amount, or lease, you know, option to buy at a year, but this price is 6 months and this price is a year. I mean, it's like anything, just be creative about it, and you're depending on who you're dealing with and you know, what makes sense. Maybe this particular person that's looking to buy, you know, from you maybe doesn't have the capital right now to actually buy it, but you know they're going to buy it and they're going to do well off it. So okay, well then it will be creative and maybe just do that, you know, shorter term lease. You can buy it out for X amount after 3 months, X amount, 6, 9, 12, whatever, or just you lease it for a year and then you send it back, or you know.
So Ash, how's it feel going to like Keeneland or Churchill Downs or something, and you know, just looking around at the people all dressed fancy and everything, and you're the actual only horse guy in the room, you know? Like I feel, Kyle, like I feel like if we threw some money at this horse thing, we could go to Churchill Downs or Keeneland opening day at Keeneland and be like, hey, we're investing in horses, we're in the horse business.
I still wouldn't know what a trifecta was or a show or a place or anything like that, because we would be investing in the guys that got to jump over three poles and not knock any down.
Yeah. But you're still a lot more. You're in the horse business.
We wouldn't be allowed to go. You know, you and I would not be allowed to go to any of these events, right?
No. I'd open my mouth.
We're far too hillbilly to be in that.
I don't know about that. I mean, it's kind of funny. If I go to, like, I've been to Keeneland a lot, you know, because I spent a lot of time in Lexington. So I go to Keeneland and I don't have a clue. Honestly, like racing, I don't have a clue what's going on. I don't have a clue about the breeding, you know, any of the training stuff. I just, from being these events, I thankfully have met some really amazing people and met some very famous people that everybody knows in the racing world. But I don't have a clue what's going on. So, I mean, it's not like it's any different for me, but what's interesting is you guys will probably do better. And in terms of like networking, because it's like, I feel like, you know, a lot of people that invest in racehorses, again, it's part of the, oh, you know, I invested in the horse, but those syndications, you know, I have yet to meet somebody that's actually made money out of investing in a racing syndication. It's more about the fact that, oh, you know, you can say you know, maybe you have a photo with the horse winning or something, but they tack in so many fees, and not to kind of, you know, blast against the racing world or anything, but you know, I just don't know many people that have made money from investing in it. And you're, you know, you own like, you know, an eighth or whatever, or even less in terms of what you actually have into, because it's, they, you know, they pull so many people together in that syndication like avenue that I just don't think there's anything there. But so for you guys to come in and say, oh, I own a show jumping horse, you know, in the equestrian world and whatever else, it's like people are like, oh, wow.
Yeah. You guys are actually, like, you know, who are these fancy people? You guys are
more involved and have more, you know, knowledge or whatever than us.
Kyle, you could go like to Keeneland in an ascot with like a pipe and like maybe a monocle. And then people are like, who's this guy? He must be somebody. Oh, he's in the horse world. I talked to him earlier. Yeah, he's in the horse.
That'd be the one time I shave with a razor this year.
You could have like your mint julep walking around, and yeah, that'd be nice, dude.
Oh, those things are garbage.
Oh, you, okay. Well, you'd have your bourbon.
I'd rather just have the bourbon. You can save all the tutu crap for that and another one is old fashioned. Everybody on Louisville is always about old fashioned. And then my neighbor got into them. Have you ever tasted a bitter before, Adam?
No.
It's like ruining good bourbon with black licorice. It's terrible.
Oh, it sounds disgusting.
It is. That sounds bad. A lot of people love them.
I'm a big bourbon. I'm a big bourbon guy. Actually, I'm obsessed, which is another reason I love being in Kentucky. And then I'm pretty good with. I mean, actually, we'll name drop for a good reason. So Justin's House of Bourbon, they have a location, as you know, in Louisville, and I'm pretty tight with the guys there and from the Lexington one. So I love going to that one to pick up some pretty awesome bourbon. So I'm a big bourbon guy. Old fashions for sure. Absolutely love.
Do your family members back in, or friends or anything back in Europe, do they ever get jealous of you with your pictures of like Kentucky bourbons, like your selection of bourbons that you have?
No, they honestly, I feel like they look, especially back in the UK, you know, you have the Glenfiddiches and, you know, all those kind of, you know, amazing Scottish and Irish whiskies that, you know, people, I feel like for the most part, people look down on American bourbons, but I mean, I enjoy, you know, Woodford is my absolute favorite, Double Oak in particular. And I'll take that any day over any of the mainstream whiskeys in the UK.
It comes down to preference, because like a lot of those, like it's particularly the Scotch. If you gotta like to have, do you feel like your meat super smoky? It's kind of like the same thing. So if you like a good barbecue that's a little bit sweeter and tangier than a truly smoked brisket, that's the same idea. Like bourbon's a little bit sweeter because it's got more corn in it. That for Scotch is sometimes it's like drinking a campfire, man. It's just I just can't do it.
Ash, you ever considered flipping bourbons? Like, isn't that a thing, yes. Kyle?
Yeah, it's a big thing here.
So it's funny enough, I tried to, again, kind of just so that the two Justins, they all the time, they're like, yeah, if you find anything that's super interesting, you know, we'll buy it from you for X amount. So I kind of half an eye always look into maybe people that have, you know, some rare bourbons that either they don't know what they have or, you know, they're just sitting there. But what's interesting, I've realized there's one person I know in particular that actually does pretty well flipping, you know, rare bourbons and whiskeys, and they actually hate bourbon, which I feel like is probably the best position to be in, because I feel like if I was the one actually, you know, buying these bottles to then go and sell them on and make money, I don't honestly feel like that bottle would get end up being sold, because I'd probably end up drinking it. So I feel like it's probably a good thing that I maybe stay out of that.
Kyle, this should be the business I'm in. I don't even drink, but I could just flip bourbons. Because I'd never care about drinking it. This is why I should have a bar.
You really should. I mean, I think statistics say that one of the best appreciated asset classes is actually, you know, bourbon.
Wow. Yes,
like 30 years.
Interesting.
It is. It's up there with, watches is the other one that's up there with. And
well, your buddy flips watches. We're trying to get him on that. Yeah, we might try to get him on the show next week or something. But also, you know, you've also got like a kind of a, I don't know if it's a day job or what it is a, you look for what sustainable investments for a company, right?
Yeah. So I'm part of, I'm with the Tesla Foundation, which is, before anyone gets too excited, it's a completely separate entity to Tesla Inc. Even though it shares common roots in terms of the founder of the foundation used to work with Elon and kind of branched off. I mean, we follow the routes of Nikola Tesla. That's really our sort of, you know, our kind of roots come from that particularly, as opposed to, you know, what Elon's doing with Tesla and everything else there. But our focus is on looking for opportunities, technologies, companies, innovations that are really have a main focus around sustainability. And within that, you know, anything from renewable energies to stopping climate change, you know, I'm looking at deal right now, it's in water security. Really, you know, it's funny. So I grew up in England, you know, grew up on a farm, used to big diesel engines, used to polluting a lot and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I still have my horses, we pull them with a 3500 GMC dually, you know, so, you know, we still have that, but like I've noticed and where the world is at today, I mean, look what's happening from the forest fires right now, the droughts in California, we're seeing forest fires in Greece. I mean, all these crazy weather events that keep happening, like global climate change, global warming is here. Like it's not 30, 40 years away. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been on some really amazing events in the last few weeks and around sustainability. And obviously with Biden coming in with this $4 trillion infrastructure bill, Boris Johnson is heavily, you know, focused now on alternative energy solutions. And so really, you know, what I'm doing, the work I'm doing now is focused on finding these types of technologies, these companies, and either helping raise capital for them, us partnering with them, the goal being to take them some to some kind of big exit. You know, typically speaking, an IPO is kind of really where we want to take these companies, and us obviously twofold with this, you know, doing something that's actually going to improve humanity, but also obviously looking to make, you know, money as well. Because, you know, 10, not even, I guess, maybe even 2 years ago, people looked at sustainability as being, oh, that's a charity thing. You know, that's, oh, let's just put money to this because it's like, oh, it's cute. You know, we can say, hey, you know, we're helping save the planet. But we're just seeing now with so much money going into ESG, going into sustainability, you know, all these different funds that are popping up, the capital is coming into this type of sector. It's just astounding. And my goal actually going into next year is actually I'm going to start Tesla Climate Capital. I've already created the GP aspect of that for anyone tries to go in and steal the steal the branding and then hold it ransom and then try and make me pay crazy money for it. So I have already that entity established, but our goal will be to, you know, focus on investing in climate change technologies. And we already have, you know, just with the foundation side, we already have like half a dozen companies in the portfolio that, you know, are real impact opportunities and real have a huge avenue to actually helping, you know, curb some of the climate change issues.
What kind of money are you guys managing? Like, what do you have in the fund? Like, what do you have access to?
My goal is to launch the first fund of $50 million. That's my goal for the first fund. Again, right now, the company is from the foundation side. We're not holding capital. We're literally raising capital for these companies through the with basically leveraging the foundation, supposed to, like, we don't have a fund structure set up. My goal is to create a fund and to kind of to actually, you know,
wow,
have it in a real structured format. So our goal is, like I say, we're partnered right now with these companies. We take an equity stake. We basically come in, figure out the business development side, you know, where areas in the business that we can really add value. And also with that, you know, get everything structured in a way whereby we can also go out and look to raise capital for the company as well and help it to continue to grow. And then again, as I said, the big exit in mind, the big IPO being the ultimate goal. But when I flip over next year and we start the fund and I end up closing that out, then that will be obviously a different angle. We'll be actually looking to actively be the ones that invest, but then also bring in all the resources we have with the foundation, run them through everything, as I said, again, ultimately with the big exit in mind with the IPO. So I would say that, you know, if you want to class it as like a particular type of fund, it would be a late stage VC. So companies that already have established business operations, they already have established proof of concept, but it's for us to take them from that point to, you know, actually global presence and that, you know, IPO.
Have you ever looked at 80 Acres Farm up in Hamilton, Ohio? So we had some VCs here from Cali, and I think they just recently put, I think, $7 million into that. And I don't know if they have an open, I think they've closed the opportunity at this point, but I'm sure they'll have another one. But, and I'm not sure if it was Series B, Series C, but I mean, they're kicking butt. But 80 Acres Farm, I think around here, that's probably the biggest sustainability option, or investment opportunity, like in the whole Cincinnati kind of area. So yeah, that might be something to look at too. But, Ash, man, it's freaking awesome to have you on here, man. I mean, I've been wanting to get you on here for a while now, and you got horses, you got sustainability, you know, you don't got soccer, you don't care about that.
I love Formula One. I
don't know if there you go, Formula that. One. Yeah, I don't know much about Formula One, but you're in pretty good.
I might as well talk about rugby.
Yeah, I know you're in, but you are in a good location for it. I mean, you drive south, you're in Louisville to deal with the horses, and then if you go west, you're in Indianapolis, and you could go watch a race there. Maybe not a Formula One race, but an IndyCar race is kind of, you know, similar.
similar. Yeah, it's similar for sure. I know, you know, Dan Pearson, with every day with, I mean, Dan is a huge Formula One fan as well. So we're always talking about different events, and his goal is actually to get us part of Pearson Equity Group is to have a box at the Miami Formula One race in May next year. That's I don't know if he's talked to you about that.
No, but I'm down. Yeah,
I'll plan to do that and have all our LPs come and you know, have an event and just basically write it off as a big, you know, corporate opportunity.
Hey, I'm a potential LP.
He may become an LP at the race. So let's see.
Yep.
Cool. Well, all right, Ash. Well, I appreciate your time. This has been awesome, man. I think people learned a lot. How do people reach out if they're interested?
Either probably Instagram. I'm pretty active. Just Ash Atkinson and the number one, just because somebody has Ash Atkinson as itself. So I had to drop a one in there, which I don't know. Maybe I got to do something different. I don't know. So anyway, I'm not a super creative guy. So I just was like, all right, fine. Add the one. So that's really the best way. I mean, LinkedIn, Ash Atkinson as well. I mean, Google me. There's a ton of ways. I don't hide any of my my contact information, so it's pretty easy to get hold of me.
So on LinkedIn, what's the location? Like, if somebody was to look up Ash Atkinson, I'm sure there's a bunch of Ash Atkinsons out there. Where's your?
It'd be West Palm Beach, Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, nice, man. Awesome. I like West Palm Beach. My wife lived in West Palm for a little while there. Big fans.
I love the area.
It's turning around too. West Palm's actually. I mean, downtown West Palm. I mean, it's nice.
You can go to Peanut. Is it Peanut Island there?
Like, yeah,
you can take it. We go there because we used to go to Deerfield Beach every year, and we would go down to Peanut Island. That was pretty fun for the kids when they were young. The little man-made coral you can do the snorkeling with.
Yep. Yeah, that's a cute area. It's just north of West Palm Beach. That's a nice little spot for sure. I mean, obviously, like anything in South Florida with since COVID and just the influx of people. I mean, the real estate market's off the charts. You know, I can't remember the group's name that just came in and bought like four of the best, you know, commercial office assets as a portfolio. The name eludes me right now. Adam, you would know for sure who it is. I think it's like Region or something. Can't remember the guy's name.
Where was it at? Where did they buy it?
Phillips Point.
Oh, okay. Oh,
so,
wow.
Sold for, you know, huge amount over what is the valuation of the portfolio is. The market is just off the charts in all levels, from the commercial office side all the way down to single family. I mean, I have a really close buddy of mine who's a real estate broker on the island in Palm Beach. And I mean, he sold some pretty incredible units. I mean, he has one of the highest selling condo units in Palm Beach. But what's crazy right now is there's no inventory. You know, things are selling. Any property that comes up on the market, it is selling within a day, full cash, you know, over asking, and still people aren't closing deals. You know, it's just.
Well, Cervera Real Estate, they just hit me up because the place the condo we bought in Miami. Downtown Miami, they're building one of the developers that's related to that project. He hired Cervera to be the sales company, and they called me saying, hey, friends and family deal. We don't even have renderings done yet, but they just bought the last available lot that isn't already a giant building. It's like a dry cleaners or something, believe it or not, in Brickell on the river. So it's like the last spot you could build a tower. There's towers everywhere in Brickell. If nobody knows, Brickell's like the higher end business, white collar kind of neighborhood in Miami. But they're getting ready to do a new project there, and they hit us up with the deal. And I think they're starting at like $550 or something like that. But same deal, short term rental friendly. You know, you're gonna, you know, probably double your money by the time the damn thing's built in like 2025. But really good opportunities. I mean, Florida right now, it's kicking butt. So, you know, you got a lot of, I think, money moving down from New York. I think that's one of the big drivers. And you got a lot of people leaving California too. If they're not going to Texas or Arizona, or Boise, Idaho, they're probably coming down to, you know, they're coming down to Florida. They're going to those no tax states. So big money.
I was going to say, I have a buddy of mine. He does a lot of fun compliance work, but from New York, moved down to actually to Miami. He got a real estate license in Florida. And now he is basically, all his buddies up in New York, they're all hightailing it down to Florida. Everyone that comes, yeah, he's sourcing them properties. And then now he's got to a point where he's actually put together a syndication where they're going out and purchasing 5-10 unit buildings through his real estate license as well. He's putting the capital together. And obviously his buddies, they're either staying in the units when they're here or they're just renting them out.
Yeah, I'm getting my real estate license. Like, what the hell? You know, like, I mean, yeah. I'm going to get one just because I'm looking to invest in, you know, more in Florida and Kentucky. If you get your license in Kentucky, there's a reciprocity or whatever it is. Yeah, reciprocity. Yeah, reciprocity with Florida. So I can just, you know, be an agent in Florida if I wanted to. And then all these people that I know that are going to eventually want to be snowbirds down in Florida, they'll come to me. And, you know, what the heck? I mean, I'm just doing it just to kind of, you know, fuck, we built like the most popular real estate software and I never got my real estate license. So just like, you know, a thing that it's like, I might as well get my real estate license. Why not? You know?
Yeah. I swear I have my real estate license, even though I don't actively sell it or anything, but
yeah, why not? 89 yeah. bucks a year or something to keep it up. So it's like, who cares? Yeah. I might as well do it. So anyway, Ash, yeah. Hey, Kyle, you got anything else for Ash? Any other questions?
No, I just, hopefully sometime when you come to Lexington, we can meet up.
Yeah. For sure. I'm not sure when right now that'll be, but absolutely. I mean, my goal next year is to be based there in the summer. I mean, I'm based there. This is the first year we actually, we're in Nashville this summer. But typically I like to be in Lexington. So, and I love the town. I have some great friends there. It's great, great memories there. And, so fingers crossed, we'll be there next summer for sure. If not soon.
All right. Well, enjoy your weekend, Ash.
Hang out with the hillbilly.
Yeah. Hang out with all the country folk. All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of Side Hustle City. Well, you've heard from our guests. Now let's hear from you. Join our community on Facebook, Side Hustle City. It's a group where people share ideas, share their inspirational stories, and motivate each other to be successful and turn their side hustle into their main hustle. We'll see you there, and we'll see you next week on the show. Thank you.